Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and you can find us where podcasts are played. The new Knesset was sworn in this week. A government? Not so fast. That will still take some time. If the new Knesset members can even succeed at something those before them have failed to do after the three previous elections. On this week's show, we talk to one of these new members of Knesset, what we call MKs. He's one who's making history. His name? Gilad Kariv. And the reason Gilad Kariv is making history is because he's the first Reform rabbi to enter the halls of Parliament. He's not just any rabbi, those we have plenty of, he's a Reform rabbi. Kariv served as the head of the Reform movement in Israel since 2009, a journey he didn't believe as a young man he would even take. What did he originally dream of? You got it, entering the Knesset. After all, people do say that a rabbi needs to be a bit of a politician. This became possible when Kariv ran in the Labor Party primaries about a month and a half ago and came in the fourth slot, with Labor coming back literally from the dead and securing seven seats in the March 23rd election. Kariv is now officially an Israeli MK. He's been a strong activist for religious freedom and pluralism in Israel. He fought for the Kotel Compromise, for conversion recognition, and for civil marriage. We'll hear from him now on these issues as a member of Knesset. And to finish us off, I'm joined by Mayan Hoffman, our coronavirus analyst. We talk about the numbers in Israel, the low infection rate, what's happening with our vaccines, how politics keep getting in the way, and if we Israelis really can claim that COVID is behind us. Mayan doesn't think so. Let's begin.
So Rabbi Kariv, it's great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast. And let me just start by saying congratulations on being elected to the Knesset. That must be a big accomplishment. I know you've run in previous primaries, and this is a big success to be able to make it in.
Yes, well, I need to say that I dreamt to become a Knesset member much before I thought I will be a Reform rabbi. And this is something that attracted my mind and heart since I was quite a young child. It was a very positive experience to be elected in the Labor primaries. It was even a bigger, not surprise, but it was a bigger excitement when the Labour Party succeeded to revive itself and to become once again a player in Israeli politics.
What do you think it means, though? You know, a lot of our listeners are coming from North America, and you are the representative of what is by far, I think, the largest organized stream of Judaism, the Reform movement. You've served as its head here in Israel for a number of years in a very high-profile position at the forefront of many battles, which we'll get into a bit, against the situation here with religion and state, whether it was the Western Wall, the Kotel, conversion, civil marriage. What does it mean, maybe on a symbolic level, to have a Reform rabbi in the Israeli parliament?
Look, first, I need to say it's not a secret to your audiences that we experienced some very challenging years in the complicated arena of Israel diaspora relations. And I think that after those critical years, during which I think many progressive Jews around the world and in Israel felt that the Israeli government is turning its back on them. I think that the fact that I will be in the Knesset as a Reform rabbi signals the Jewish world and the Israeli society that progressive Judaism, liberal Judaism, Reform and conservative Judaism are truly becoming to be part of the Israeli mainstream. Now, we claimed it for many years that quietly there is a spiritual and communal positive revolution in Israel, and that more and more secular Israeli families and traditional Israeli families identify us as their Jewish address. And when I'm saying us, it's not only the Reform movement. As I said, It's the reform movement, it's conservative, it's the conservative movement, and it's all the other frameworks of what we call the pluralistic Jewish renewal movement in Israel. And again, we claimed for years that it is becoming to be a major player in Israel's spiritual, ideological life. And I think that the fact that I was elected first inside the Labor Party, and then together with my friends to the Knesset, when I'm holding the flag of pluralism, freedom of religion, and full recognition to all Jewish communities and streams, I think in a way it closes the story. It shows that even if we have many challenges, you know, with some of the Israeli governments, even when we don't forget the strength, the political strength, and I need to say also the communal strength of the.
I have to challenge you on that, Rabbi Kariv, because the you know, in the Knesset still, and I see personally your election also as a monumentous step and a big leap forward for Israel and for taking steps in a progressive and pluralistic direction. But I also can't ignore the fact that there are, 15 members of Knesset right now of the ultra-Orthodox parties from Shas and Yadut HaTorah, United Torah Judaism, who, if I'm not mistaken, will probably, if they see you walking in their direction, they might either turn around, but they'll definitely not work with you on legislation.
Look, definitely. No one is trying to offer that there is no strong presence to ultra-Orthodoxy to ultra-Orthodoxy in Israel or to modern Orthodoxy. It is clear that, not like in North America, the progressive communities in Israel are still a minority. But again, for us, it's not new. It's not news that the ultra-Orthodox parties enjoy a very strong, a political presence in the Knesset and outside the Knesset.
Monopoly, even, you could say, by the way.
Yes, legislated, of course. The Orthodox establishment enjoys a monopoly and also receives huge public funding that we do not enjoy. But as you said, look, it's a process. But I think, you know, for many, many years when I attended Knesset committees and I spoke on behalf of progressive Judaism, those ultra-Orthodox Knesset members that stayed in the room and didn't leave it shouted at me, you're representing no one in Israel. Maybe you are representing many Jews overseas, but here in Israel, no one understands why we need Reform Judaism. So I think that the members of the Labor Party and the many voters of the Labor Party sent a different message in that regard. Now, look, I'm the first one to know that this is only the beginning of a journey. And we didn't, you know, I will enter tomorrow the Knesset. And for me, as I said, since I was a kid, it's a promised land. But progressive Judaism, Reform Judaism, those Israeli Jews that believe in pluralism and freedom of religion, we do not enter the promised land. We're just starting the journey in the desert. But I know that we are in the right direction. I can share with you, I'll share with you a story from today. We had today a training session in the Knesset for the new Knesset members. And I will share with you that at least three workers of the Knesset, people from the professional teams of the Knesset, talked with me about a Reform wedding to their children or a Reform bar mitzvah to their grandchildren. So you understand, it's part of a bigger phenomena that Israel is embracing a more open and pluralistic approach towards the question of Judaism, Jewish values, and Jewish identity.
You know, I've always thought, meeting a lot of rabbis over the years, and I'm anything but a rabbi, but a rabbi has a lot of kind of different interests that always he or she has to manage, right? When dealing in a congregation, you have congregants who want you to be more conservative, want you to be more liberal, want a prayer service to go this way, want a prayer service to go that way. And you always have to kind of juggle between those conflicting interests. So by you saying that you had always dreamed of being a politician even before being a rabbi, to me, it's kind of like the two are almost go hand in hand to an extent, yes. No?
Look, I think that by definition, every congregational rabbi is also a politician. I'm glad that not all politicians are rabbis, but I definitely think that being a congregational rabbi in Tel Aviv for 10 years and heading the reform movement for another 10 years and actually establishing more than 25 reform congregations across the country with my colleagues during the last 10 years, it definitely gave me necessary skills for my time in the Knesset. And I think that the most important one is first to be patient and to understand that also in politics, we're talking about processes and converting the hearts of your colleagues inside the Knesset and the government systems. And also in the Israeli audience. And the second thing, that in the end, it's all about your ability to balance between your values, or actually to keep your values and to walk according to your values, even if you need to make political compromises. And it's right. Clear that when you're dealing with politics, it's also about making compromises. The question is, can you tell yourself in the end of the day that those compromises are serving your values? And so, I hope that this is the thing that we will be able to do in the Knesset.
So I do want to talk to you about the state of religion in Israel, because we at the Jerusalem Post, our editorial line has been very steadfast in recent years against what has been this ultra-Orthodox monopoly over everything that has to do with religion and state. What happened with the Kotel and the failure, the decision by this prime minister and one of his previous governments to withdraw from the earlier compromise that was supposed to build a pluralistic prayer plaza. What's happening with civil marriage, that still hundreds of thousands of Israelis cannot get married. And this situation is even worse during the pandemic when they can't just travel overseas. But even the idea of someone who's Israeli, a citizen, who served in the army, who pays taxes, to have to leave the country to get married is so absurd in my mind. But you have, so on the one hand, you still have the rabbinate, which is, in my view, and this is my term, strangling Judaism in Israel, right? Doing the opposite of what it's supposed to do. And on the other hand, though, you do have small successes, and you were involved in the recent high court decision, right? Which now has allowing reform and conservative conversions in Israel to be recognized for the purpose of citizenship under the law of return. So sometimes it seems like we go backwards, but sometimes we go forward. How do you look at the overall picture?
So, first of all, I fully agree it's a delicate dance. And again, I think that the main question is, are we going one step forward and two steps back? Or are we going two steps forward and one step back? And I think that in recent years, it's the second scenario that reflects the Israeli reality. I'm not ignoring the many challenges we face here in Israel with the, I need to say, a wrong behavior of the ultra-Orthodox leadership, political leadership, and also the rabbinical leadership. And I think we all saw it during the pandemic. But still, when it comes to religion and state, I'm quite optimistic. I think that there is a growing Israeli audience, which goes today beyond the borders or the borderline between orthodoxy and secularism. I think that today the dividing line is going through the Orthodox community in Israel, and the camp that calls for a change, a radical change in the relations between state and religion includes not only secular Israelis and liberal Israelis, but also modern Orthodox Israelis. Now, in that regard, I think there is a growing audience that understand we need to create a change. It's not going to be easy because the Orthodox monopoly is well rooted in the Israeli political culture, in the structure of power, in Israeli politics. It is also well rooted in the, even I will say, in the culture of the country. It was handed to the ultra-Orthodox and Orthodox establishment even before the state was born. Yet, again, I think that you can see it in the numbers. You can see it in the growth of the egalitarian streams. You can see it in the feminist revolution that is taking place inside many Orthodox congregations. And in that regard, I will say that the political split today between the two parties of religious Zionism, what we call La Zionita Adatit, led by Smotrich, that unfortunately includes the successors of Kahana and even more extreme forces. But on the other end, the other party, led by Naftali Bennett, that takes a much more moderate line when it comes to religion and state. Even this split reflects, I think, a growing understanding that we need to create a change. And it will not, by definition, it will not happen in one term of the Knesset, even if it will be a full term. It's a process. Right. I think that the court, the Israeli Supreme Court, has an important role there, but also, of course, the Israeli Knesset and the government, and we are committed to push this process. It's important, as you said, to say it's not only a threat to the democratic values of Israel, you know, for the freedom of religion and conscience of 9 million Israelis. It's a real threat to the Jewish character of the state of Israel because it pushes back millions of Israeli Jews that say to themselves that if Judaism is what they see in the ultra-Orthodox establishment, they prefer not to be engaged. Right. And this is something we need to change.
We need to change. The just finally, before we wrap up, Mirav Micheli, the leader of your party, allow me one political question, took over Labor and brought it back from the dead. It was like resurrection. What do you foresee happening as the Labor Party goes forward?
So, you know, I said to Mirav Micheli that, you know, as a Reform rabbi, we usually put the concept of Tchiyat HaMetim aside, the resurrection aside. And she, in a way, brought me to adopt this theological belief once again, because as you said, she really took a dead party. And in 2 weeks, it's amazing. I don't know if there is any similar story in the political history of the state of Israel that in 2 weeks, a leader is actually bringing a party from the dead. And I think she succeeded mainly because she presents a unique political behavior. She talks begova einayim, if I can use the Hebrew term. You know, she talks in a very open, sincere, transparent matter. She tends to play, you know, to put all the cliches aside. She's the only woman who is leading the party in the current Knesset. It's amazing. She actually brought the Labor Party to adopt a full egalitarian list in the primaries. Now, I think that in the end, the Labor Party has the ability, with Mirav, to become once again the leading force in the progressive block of Israeli politics. Right now, we are not yet there, but thank God, the bad behavior that we saw in the past in the Labor Party is disappearing. And I think that we are all committed to work with Mirav to strengthen the party. And I believe that in the next elections, and I hope it is not around the corner, but I think that in the next elections we'll see the Labour Party gaining more power. And, you know, it has to do with religion and state, because the Labour Party this time came with a very clear platform of promoting religious pluralism and Jewish diversity in Israel. Me being in the list is part of that, and I was encouraged by Merav to join the primaries. So the Labour Party is definitely part of this big bloc that calls for changes in the status quo. At the same time, the Labour Party is one of the few parties that didn't run a rough campaign, or a campaign that included right. incitement against other sectors, including the ultra-Orthodox community.
Right.
And for me, this is the politics we need here in Israel. The ability at the same time to say the right things in a courageous manner and still identify the legitimacy of all Israeli communities.
Rabbi Gilad Kariv, I want to thank you again for joining us, and congratulations on being sworn in as a new member of the Israeli Knesset.
Thank you. Toda rabba.
Mayan, so great to have you. We're talking because Corona is still in the news, of course, but for Israel, at least, things seem to be under control. Numbers are at unprecedented low levels, like never seen before since the beginning of this crisis when we just had a few cases. And the fact that the vaccination campaign still is moving along. We have over half of our country who's vaccinated at this stage. Schools have gone back pretty much. We'll talk about that in a moment. But with all this is going on and things seem to be really rosy to an extent, there's still a lot of glitches. One of them is with the vaccines this week. What exactly is happening there?
Okay, so first of all, let's go over the numbers, and then let's go over the vaccines. So the numbers are good. You're right, they're low. It's only 0.6% today who came back positive, and that's a fabulous number. It's the lowest since May. That being said, we're still seeing infection in the country. You know, it looks rosy, but there was a Bedouin wedding where 100 people got infected because a very low percentage of them are vaccinated. And our general weekly vaccination numbers have dropped tremendously, partially because a lot of people are vaccinated, but there's still about 1 million Israelis who are not vaccinated, including over 200,000 of people over the age of 50 who are choosing not to vaccinate.
How many of them, by the way, do you know come from the ultra-Orthodox and Arab sector?
Well, it's interesting. They're the highest percentages for sure, but Bedouin Arab is actually the highest grouping of people over the age of 16 who are choosing not to get vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why you had this incident, for example, with the Arab the Bedouin
wedding. 100 people
in one, because people were not vaccinated. They're actually looking into now whether or not somebody came to the wedding knowing that he or she was infected with corona, but we don't know. And it really...
Great way to blow up the wedding.
You see, it really spread rapidly, right? So you have to remember that corona is still here. It's just that with the vaccinations, we don't get serious disease. But people still need to vaccinate. Haredim and Arabs are around, I think it was 80% of the people over the age of 50, whereas we're over 90% of the general population. So it certainly is a difference within those communities. Now, in terms of what's going on with the vaccines, you know, it's great. We got our vaccines. We purchased, remember, from Pfizer vaccines. We purchased vaccines from Moderna. We have vaccines expected to come someday, maybe, if we still believe in them, from AstraZeneca, and we should have, you know, some vaccines in the country. But apparently we are getting cut off from Pfizer right now. Things could change any day, but we have not paid for our Pfizer vaccines. We paid for the first shipment, 10 million vaccines. There's another 2.5 million that we received when we were having some trouble fulfilling our, the number of people who wanted to get vaccinated. And somehow we never paid for them. In addition, we have outstanding contracts waiting for us to sign for another, need it or not, 30 million or some odd, you know, vaccines from Pfizer. And we haven't signed those contracts. And why? We haven't signed them, not because we aren't sure if we want the vaccines or not. I mean, there are differences of opinions, but because the governments, of course.
So let's just take a step back for a moment. Okay. So we have a situation where we know, at least based on what we see right now, numbers are low. Vaccines are working. People are staying healthy. Less infections.
Pfizer's told us they last for at least 6 months.
Israelis are able to go out. We were able to celebrate Passover together. They could go to dinner. They could go to theater. They could get on an airplane, come back. No quarantine. All great.
Movie theaters are opening in 2 weeks.
Right. So we know that, and we know that's because of the vaccines. But at the same time, we're saying, well, we're not going to order more vaccines. So how does that make sense?
I mean, the question is how long the vaccine will last and whether or not it will be a worthwhile purchase. This is the dilemma among health professionals, is whether or not we would get too many, they would expire, whether or not we will never need them, we'll take these vaccines from other people who maybe otherwise could have them. There's a question about whether or not they're necessary.
Okay, but that's the health issue, but there's also the political.
Let's talk about the political issue, right. So from a health perspective, though, I mean, I just want to say that I think that the majority of health professionals, though, do believe we should bring the vaccines in. Pfizer announced last week, right, that kids over the age of 12 to 16, can vaccinate. We know that we can't achieve true herd immunity. Again, there's always a, you know, machlokets here as a vision even within the health community, but basically we know we need to vaccinate those children. We do not have vaccines to vaccinate them right now inside the country. With regards to political issues, what happens was this. Benny Gantz on April 2nd, his position as interim justice minister ended. He had been filling a position from somebody, of course, who had stepped down, and asked to convene a meeting to get a permanent appointment as justice minister. Logical request, one might think, but of course, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu did not feel that this was something he wanted to do, and refused to agree to convene the government to approve that appointment, as well as the purchase of the vaccines. So when it came to light that we were not going to be approving the justice ministry appointments, Benny Gantz decided we're not going to have a meeting. Now, remember, it's a unity government, so obviously they have to both agree to come to this cabinet meeting. They don't agree. There's no cabinet meeting.
So this is just, you know, one of these examples that we've spoken about before here on the podcast, and we write about it quite often online and in the newspaper and the Jerusalem Post, of what is actually happens when you have a situation of political instability in Israel and this deadlock and the election cycles that go on. Like, this is a real-life example that people tend to say, well, what does it make a difference? But here it makes a difference, right?
Here's a huge difference.
Israel's not signing the contracts to purchase more vaccines from Pfizer. And as a result...
And it looks bad.
And it looks... We look bad with Pfizer, right? There have been reports coming out in different media that they're calling us a banana republic. Or even if they're not using that term, they're highly critical of why are we not a normal country that's organized? Welcome to Israel. But here's a real example of how this just... anarchy, the balagan, as we call it in Hebrew, is raging. And despite the fact that we know scientifically, again, that the vaccines work.
Right. We know. I mean, look, we are the vaccination nation who refuses to buy vaccines right now. I mean, that's what you're looking at. You're looking at a country who rolled out vaccines first and faster than anybody else.
Right.
And now has an opportunity to complete it and will likely not be able to because of instability.
Let's hope that maybe they'll figure it out and they'll find a way to resolve the situation. Let's assume that they do, right? Mm-hmm. So if they do, what's the forecast looking forward? Like, where do you see us? Like, you know, they get the vaccines, everyone keeps on vaccinating, they get the kids 12 to 16, then they do clinical trials, and the younger kids even, they get them vaccinated. We're looking good. Are we out of this mess?
In Israel, you're out of it if that continues. If you vaccinate the 12 to 16-year-olds, if Pfizer continues to test younger children and eventually, I mean, even without the younger children, you're probably out of it because you have to remember that the youngest children, the very small percentage ever actually really become sick. So your hospitals are fine, your country's opened up, people are back in school, and everything is good. Yeah, I mean, look, even today, right, what happened today, it's Monday after Passover break. And as you mentioned, the majority of kids went back to school. Who didn't go back to school? The kids between full-time, I should say. The kids over third grade, they're still in capsules up through fourth grade.
Some days they're in school, some days they're home.
Right, so it's quite confusing. But and it's very, very, very frustrating for the children, very frustrating for the parents. It seems like, look, they were out of as you mentioned, all of these festivities over Pesach, why can't they go back to school? But the health ministry, either way, even if we have to have a little bit of a delay within the next month, everybody's back in school. Because what they really said is, look, we'll open up the third graders without capsules. In another week, if it all goes well, 2 weeks, you know, when we don't see infection rising, we'll give it to the rest of the middle through middle school. And within a very short period of time, everyone's back. And yeah, Israel is great. But that doesn't mean that we're done with corona. And why doesn't that mean we're done with corona? There's two issues. Issue number one is mutations. So our airports are open. They've been open since March 20th for Israelis. Foreigners are not so readily, you know, able to get into the country. But Israelis are going and coming. It was just Passover break. They could get infected. They could bring back a mutation. We haven't been able to manage the political crisis. We also haven't been able to manage Ben-Gurion Airport.
Right, but right now, anyone who comes back, either if they're vaccinated, they just get tested and are let out. And if they're not vaccinated, they go into home quarantine with this electronic bracelet.
Well, right? If we had enough electronic bracelets, sure, that would be great. And if we were following up and making sure that they were really in quarantine, it would work well. And if everybody was actually for sure being tested, it would be sufficient. What we know is that it's not working 100%.
Surprise,
right? I can even tell you that my father-in-law, a personal story, you know, left the other day to go back to the States. And there's a requirement to take a coronavirus test as you board the plane. and when you return to the country, either direction, which is very important because, by the way, you could also spread it around the airplane. And, you know, he gets to the airport and he's vaccinated and he's got his test, but it's not within the time frame or whatever that they wanted. And they said, oh, you actually can't get the test. And really the test, they say they take 4 hours, but they don't take 4 hours. They might take longer. So we're not necessarily going to be able to do it. He did get on the plane. It all worked out. But there was hours of, you know, confusion within the airport as to whether or not he'd even be able to board the plane because they didn't know they would get him the test results in time. So, you know, it is still confusing at the airport and still a lot of people are coming and going. And again, you come in and you don't, and let's say you test, but you have a very rapidly infectious mutation. And you are vaccinated, and so you don't have to go into isolation, and you spread it. There's all these possibilities, but we can't live that way.
There's a country I was supposed to travel to, which now that those travel plans are off, but originally when I was looking to get the visa for work, I went to the embassy to apply for the visa, gave in the forms, came back a few days later. They said, you have to now come back a few days later and pick up your passport with the visa, and you need to come with a negative corona test. And I said, but I'm only traveling a week or two after I pick up the visa. Why do I need to pick up the visa with a negative test? That's the rule. You need a negative test to pick up the visa, even though you're only traveling 2 weeks later.
So essentially you need to take two tests in order to travel.
Right. But to come apply for the visa, I didn't need a negative test. Why does that make sense? God only knows.
That makes no sense at all.
It makes no sense. But as we know, there's all these crazy rules and restrictions on how people travel and where they can go and how they can do things. Do you think, you know, Mayan, from just talking to people who are running the show on all this over the last year, do you foresee that, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are yearning, longing to come visit Israel. They're not Israeli citizens. Your father-in-law, because he's an Israeli citizen, dual citizen, right? He's able to travel here. But most people are not. Are we going to let them back in? I mean, people in America are getting vaccinated. Can they come here?
I think they're going to be able to. I actually think by the summer, we're going to manage to get it opened up. And, you know, the health ministry is working very hard on these green passport contracts. You know, we're being able to recognize each other's vaccination certificates. They've been working on it since the beginning, but you have to remember this is new in most countries. America is just starting to mass vaccinate. It's going to take time. They have paper certificates. They need to figure out how are you going to know that it's forged, not forged, those kind of things. But my hunch is that we will actually be able to start letting foreigners in with, again, a negative coronavirus test, a vaccine certificate, a negative coronavirus test when they arrive.
And probably a serological test.
And probably a serological test as well, exactly. And at that point, you know, also they'll genetically screen. They're working on making sure that everybody who tests positive with a PCR test, that they then send the sample back to the lab and they genetically sequence it in order to just make sure that there wasn't some kind of a crazy mutation on that test.
When did we first write about setting up a proper testing center at the airport? How early on in the pandemic was that something that was spoken about?
I mean, we spoke about it within the
first...
Because
this all happened, let's say, March. So what, like by May already it was being spoken about?
Oh, yeah. Actually, it was Mary Regev, new government.
Right.
That was one of the first things that she was going to set up. And at the same time, Ronny Gamzu, coronavirus commissioner member, set up in August.
Right.
He began speaking about it, but only when, you know, I think it was... Yeah, I would say between May and August, the talks
happens. And you still
happens,
can't get that four-hour test, huh?
You mostly the time can't. I mean, I understand that actually it sometimes works. Like this
sometimes
time,
works.
You know, it sometimes works. And you can. It's best to go with your own, you know, within 72 hours to have a surefire, you know, no issues when you get there and you can get on the airplane.
Incredible.
Yeah, incredible.
Well, Mayan, thanks for the update on Corona. Still with us, not yet completely gone, but looking good at least for now, as long as we get the vaccines.
Thanks, Jacob.
Thanks for joining us. See you next week.